season 5, like, oh, I'm sorry.
Wow. Well,
I am death, destroyer of worlds.
I was expecting Brandon to go with that one. Welcome to season 5, guys.
On that note, let us begin. Here we go.
Fuck.
Welcome to the very first episode of season 5 of Three and a Half Gentlemen. We're the podcast where three of the four hosts provide a refined and intellectual analysis of movies from our private collections, while one of us tries desperately to keep up. We'll let you decide which host is which, but for now, my name is Sean, and with me, destroying the universe by pressing atoms together, are my co-hosts, Jeremiah.
Power stays in the shadows, yo. What up?
Eddie.
These things are hard on your heart.
And Brandon.
Brilliance makes up for a lot, yo.
Jerry, I got you. Throwing that right back at you, buddy.
That's what I'm talking about.
I'm catching it.
So we're going to do this all season.
There we go.
Fuck yeah.
Bring it on, season 5.
With season 5, we're changing things up a bit. We'll still be picking movies that we think will be fun to talk about. But for this season, we're playing a loose version of Six Degrees, where each host chooses their film based on the previous movie. As long as the next movie has the same actor, actress, composer, director, or writer. So at the end of last year, we randomly selected the order, which is Brandon, Eddie, Jeremiah, and then Sean. Along with this format, we'll be including a few special episodes this season of the new releases in theaters and on streaming services, along with a TV season or two.
As with every review we give, our goal is to answer one simple question: how many drinks does it take to get through the film that we just watched? Now, at the end of the podcast, we'll rate the movie based on the scale of 0 to 5. 0 being a perfect film that you could watch stone cold sober, and 5 being sort of the film that makes you feel like you just felt the effects of the atomic bomb firsthand.
With that, what do we have mushroom clouding our way into our a podcast this evening, gentlemen?
Tonight, we have last year's blockbuster hit, Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer, which was one half of the Barbenheimer sensation. Remember that? Good times.
No, it wasn't a good time.
It was very good times, yeah.
I don't know. While our individual picks will begin next week, as Three and a Half Gentlemen, we've decided to start season 5 with this movie since it was such a smash hit last year and has Oscar buzz circling all around it now. Oppenheimer tells the story of J. Robert Oppenheimer, the brilliant and often troubled physicist who led the Manhattan Project to create the atomic bomb in the 1940s to end World War II. The insanely star-studded cast is led by Cillian Murphy. Cillian Murphy, Robert Downey Jr. Yeah. It sounded weird. Didn't it sound weird? Did it sound weird to you, too? It's like Celtics or Celtics. We don't even know. Let's try it again.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The insanely star-studded cast is led by Cillian Murphy, Robert Downey Jr., Emily Blunt, and Matt Damon. Oppenheimer has earned an IMDb rating of 8.4 out of 10 and has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 93% with the critics and an audience score of 91%.
Perfect.
As with every movie that we review, we try to pair our selection with a cocktail that we hope enhances the viewing experience. So, Ed, why don't you take us through the cocktail that we will be enjoying as we watch this 3-hour movie?
A lot of drinks, guys. A lot of drinks.
You know, I didn't see that I had another part, so I thought I was in the clear. So this is my first time looking at this. So tonight, this is all fresh here, guys. Tonight, in honor of Oppenheimer's program, we're going to be enjoying a Manhattan. Did I say that right? A Manhattan?
Yeah.
Because of the Manhattan Project. Yes.
It's a classic Manhattan.
I like it. For this drink, you'll need to combine 2 ounces of rye whiskey, 1 ounce of sweet vermouth, 2 dashes of bitters in a mixing glass with ice. Next, strain the mixture into a coupe glass. If you're feeling in the mood, drain your Manhattan and then chase it with a shot of Fireball while you sit back and enjoy Oppenheimer.
I don't know why you would do that.
Yeah.
That would be terrible. No, you don't ever combine a classic Manhattan with Fireball.
I understand why.
Manhattan, you've the Manhattan Project finishes and then it's fire.
No, I understand that. But don't ruin a good Manhattan with Fireball. Secondly, in our instructions, just so you know, once you place it in the mixing glass with ice, go ahead and shake that up a little bit.
Our listeners are not idiots, Sean. Our listeners are very, very smart people. They know that if it's going in a mixing glass.
We have an obligation, Brandon, to tell the truth.
Shaking that stir.
And not just to have hearsay out there.
I like that. And Brandon, I've said something for 3 seasons straight, okay? Shaking that stir with a lemon peel. And you had to fucking switch up my whole routine here, bro. So...
No, once we did 007, once we did that one, we...
Bro, what are you getting mad? You had a lot of stuff going on in the beginning of this whole, like, you had entrance. More, you had, it was the Eddie show. I mean,
you had way more lines than anyone else. So, I mean, thank you, because I'm very happy. I used to have to say it all, which I'm happy I don't anymore. Anyway, let's start with Oppenheimer as, you know, let's look at this movie in expectations a little bit, because I know we don't do our first impressions anymore. But I had kind of low expectations for this movie going in. I have not seen the last two Christopher Nolan movies. I haven't seen Interstellar or
Interstellar was not last.
What's the other one? No, the other one.
Dunkirk?
His last one was...
No, I saw Dunkirk.
Tenet and Dunkirk.
I haven't seen Tenet and I haven't seen Interstellar. So I haven't seen either of those. Mm. I've been kind of off on Christopher Nolan. And so coming back to him was, I was not excited to do it. So that being said, I was completely blown away, but I'm very excited for this movie. So
you've never seen Interstellar? Just throw it out. You never saw Interstellar?
No, I did not see Interstellar.
So Sean and Eddie, you haven't seen it before watching it for this podcast. Jeremiah, did you see it in theaters?
No, this is the one movie that I tried desperately so hard to see it in the theaters, and I end up watching Barbie.
Okay, well, that was... That was a fail on so many levels.
The problem was is that Hannah wanted to see this movie in the IMAX 70 millimeter thing. You know, we didn't get a chance to watch it, and so that was the reason why we didn't watch it.
In theater. Sitting in a movie theater, a darkened movie theater, and seeing this on the big screen was magical. So I've seen this movie now twice, and this is the more times you see it, the better it gets. I think this is...
Well, I will tell you, I have an 85-inch television with surround sound by Bose, and it was pretty fucking interstellar on that in that movie. It was pretty immersive on that screen. So I can only imagine what you saw on the big screen.
Oh. Same here, dude. Like I waited so much to get the 4K version of this movie, and for whatever reason, like the physical media of the 4K for Oppenheimer was completely sold out. Mm. During its first and second week. So that gave me like little hopes, like, hey, people do like physical media, which is great.
It is good.
However, I was able to see it on a 75 inch, not like Sean's, you know, big.
He's got 10 inches.
I saw mine on 57 inch.
Mine was on a 75 inch, but it was glorious. It was fucking glorious, dude. So, it was so good, man.
Yeah.
So let's start. Let's talk a little bit about the pacing of the movie, because what I found for a 3-hour movie, right before I sat down to watch it, I got a text from Ed. I think it was in the group chat, and he goes, "It's 3 hours." And I went, "Oh fuck. Like, really? I'm going to sit here for 3 hours and watch this movie, and it's going to be, you know, about the life of Oppenheimer?" I thought this movie kept it so trim and such, the pacing was so good that I was literally an hour and 40 minutes in, and I was like, "What? How much longer do I have? Like, where are we going from here?"
So what baffles me about this movie, and baffles me in a good way, is that this movie defies conventional narrative structure for me, where, you know, normal narrative structure says that you have kind of peaks and you have lulls, and the movie really just kind of goes up and down as far as pacing goes. And for me, this movie has got to be one of the most, for me at least, intense cinematic experiences, where the foot doesn't let up on the gas to me at all, right? I don't know if you guys felt that, but it felt like it was constantly building and building, and you're on the edge of your seat, and there's so much tension building, and it never lets up. Like, maybe you get like him walking down a corridor, and that's, you know, half a second of I can breathe, and then next thing you know, we're back to just this insane push towards.
But you also have three different timelines working their way.
The timelines
what they did, which was what Christopher Nolan did, which I think is absolutely both brilliant and off-putting to no degree, is he made the future, not the future because it's all in the past, but the most recent timeline black and white, and the older timelines in color. And so if you watch the movie, I'm like, is this supposed to be a history before?
Yeah.
And then it was this interwoven story where you realize that it wasn't actually three different periods of time. All of them were happening at the same time. And they were telling three different sets of stories going forward in his life. And mm-hmm. I thought that was absolutely just fucking brilliant.
Yeah, Jer.
I love the fact that how this movie felt like you're watching two different movies that were being shown here. Like, you had Robert Oppenheimer's scene from his perspective that was presented in color, right? And then you had Louis Strauss, his scenes were his perspective presented in a black and white. They kind of like, you know, have it in two different ways, how you're going to view it from one perspective versus another perspective. So everything you see with Robert Downey Jr.'s character, it's all in black and white. Yeah. Everything you see with Cillian Murphy's character, it's all, you know, fusion colors and everything like
that. If you also notice all the court, I'm going to call it the courtroom scenes, but they weren't courtroom. They were
the hearing
scenes.
The FBI, I think.
The camera didn't move.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a bunch of camera movement in both the two other storylines that were going on. But when all the interviews were taking place, it was either a shot of the people asking the questions or a shot of the person answering the questions, almost like a True Detective interview with Matthew McConaughey. I don't know if anyone saw that, but it was beautifully shot, because then all of a sudden you transform into like a when the camera starts to move, it transforms into more of an action movie, which it wasn't at all. But it was scientists walking around doing math, and it just made it felt like Bruce Willis shooting up Nakatomi Plaza. Did it not? I mean, am I the only person?
No,
felt
it
that
absolutely
way?
Does.
Are they going to solve the equation?
Someone said the best here. This is a 3-hour movie about people talking about nuclear physics, and yet I was on the edge of my seat the whole time. Right?
So I was just like, okay, I feel like this is a movie that would have educated me so well in nuclear physics. I was just like, okay, I'm starting to capture this now. So
don't you want to grab a pen and start writing on Windows?
Yeah. So I also love the idea of, going back to the timeline. It did remind me, I don't know if anyone else felt the same, but it reminded me of a little bit of JFK, the movie.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. The movie is a classic. So I just thought, like, I don't know if that was on purpose, but it hit home. It's to a classic movie, and it was cool because you don't see many movies like that you nail it.
No, I agree.
And Christopher Nolan seems to be irreverent of timelines and at all giving you any indication of when and where you are. He doesn't really care to do that. It was just like, buckle up, and I'm gonna present the movie the way I want to present it, and follow up. Yeah. And that, I think that took a story that was relatively,
boring.
I'm sorry to say this, but Oppenheimer's life is boring.
Yeah.
Oppenheimer was a physicist. Oppenheimer got a bunch of the best scientists in the United States together. They did the Manhattan Project, created a great bomb. The bomb was very successful. They did not want to bomb. They did not want to use the bomb. The government took the bomb, used the bomb, and then they basically destroyed Oppenheimer's career. That's the storyline. Yes. It was very linear, simple storyline.
Christopher Nolan does. He took all those sentences and then he put them in a hat and he was like, let's pull out one of them. And it was brilliant. Right?
Yeah, and I think the most brilliant turn was the fact that Robert Downey Jr., who I just want to say, I have always known that he's a phenomenal actor. This was his crowning glory. Yeah. This was his best performance ever. And was because of the material, because of the direction, and I think because he was surrounded by absolutely phenomenal people. I mean, everyone in this movie, it's almost like they elevated their game by 10.
Yeah.
I mean, just by virtue of being on set, it felt like everyone was just performing at their highest level. Yeah. Let's put it that way.
Well, Sean, I agree. One of the best scenes, I mean, to me, you could take any number of shots and scenes of Robert Downey Jr. in this movie. But the one that hits me the most with just like the understated quality of his acting in this is when he is at the very end and he just looks at the aide and he looks at him and he says, "We didn't get the votes." Like, he knew the answer before. See, it's so understated. And
but
it's
that wasn't
so
the quiet. That wasn't the one that that wasn't the scene that won him the Academy Award, Brandon. I leaned over to you and I said, in The Fighter, Christian Bale carried the cake.
Yep.
I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, I remember.
I said he just won an Academy Award right there.
Which one is it for?
Robert Downey Jr. won when he had the breakdown about Einstein, because it was all about Einstein. At the end of the day, when he gets through with the hearing, mm-hmm. and he puts his coat, it's right there. He puts his coat on the coat rack, and the coat rack falls down.
Yeah,
and he doesn't stop. No one else cut. No one fucking breaks. And it was not supposed to happen. Nope. And you could tell it wasn't supposed to happen. And he uses that coat rack falling to propel this emotional, childlike, I am so pissed that he ruined Einstein's, a view of me in one sentence, mm-hmm. which, by the way, a great reveal. But he was crying, but not crying. It reminded you of a temper tantrum of a 12-year-old or 10-year-old mm-hmm. child, like over something that isn't a big deal, but he has just made it his whole world. Yeah. And it was so beautiful. So that is where he won the Academy Award, in my opinion.
Jeremy, I got a question after you, but Jer, go.
My question to you guys, who was your favorite actor in this movie? What was the one performance in this movie you're just like, fuck? Because I have a certain actor that I thought when I was watching it and when you guys were talking about, I thought, oh, this person just won the Academy Award. This person just won an Oscar here.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's hear it. Let's hear yours.
I'll tell you this much. Emily Blunt.
Yep.
Emily Blunt.
She was fucking awesome.
Her role, in a way, was kind of small, normally, for a lead on this one. But that
interrogation scene. Oh.
When she's when quiet, I was and watching she that, unleashes, oh,
she literally won a fucking Oscar with that scene right there. The way how she took control of the environment in the room,
mm-hmm.
I thought she knocked that out in the park. And that I'm getting chills right now. Uh-huh. Like if you can see this, my hair is sticking up right there.
It turns. At first, she was like struggling, and then all of a sudden, mm-hmm. She just got her shit together and she just nailed it.
I don't think she was struggling. I think she was actually trying to play the room to see how it was going to come at her, and she was so fierce in that scene.
Yeah.
I thought she knocked out of the park.
I think what it was is she knew that she had one chance to say everything that she wanted to say. And she was so almost writing it in her head and practicing it in her head so that when she said it, everybody did exactly what they did. Like to me, it was this deciding the right words instead of blurting it out, just really picking and choosing the right words.
With no emotion. That's my favorite part about it. It wasn't based on this hatred or anger or emotion. It was fact. And she just spit it out.
Yeah.
I will say that we got a precursor to that when I believe they were talking right before her testimony, and the attorney was like, are we sure we want to put her on the stand? Are you sure you want to do this? And Oppenheimer goes, yeah, she can handle herself just fine.
Well, we get the precursor.
Don't underestimate this woman.
Well, we get the precursor, though, when he finds out about Jean's suicide, right? And she finds him out there, and he's crying, and he's upset. And she basically says, you made this bed, so fucking sleep in it. And, basically get your ass up and move forward. Like, you can see that she is that catalyst that just prods him forward instead of holds him – not holding him back, but comforts him. Like she's not a comforting person. And that's exactly what he needed so many times in his life. And it reminds me a lot of A Beautiful Mind, where you've got Jennifer Connelly's character is at the end and you see that she's stuck with him through all the bad. When we get the same, almost the exact same scene in Oppenheimer where, he's getting the medal or he's getting the award and it's, the backroom award, but she refuses to shake Teller's hand at the end. You see that she's still with him and she's still supporting him, but she still has the same convictions that she always has. And to me, that's, I wrote in my notes, I'm like, this is a cheer inducing performance. Like you want to stand up and you want to just cheer her on because she does everything that you want somebody to do for you.
I'm not a huge fan, and I'll say this till I'm blue in the face, of movies that are anti-United States government. And I believe this movie was very anti-United States government, and rightfully fucking so. What happened in this movie, if taken as true, it makes the United States government the absolute villain, and I believe that it is true. And mm-hmm. the words that Einstein said to Robert Oppenheimer in their last meeting was basically, they're going to crucify you, and then one day it'll mm-hmm. be over. But it won't be for you. It will be for them.
Yep. Yep.
And I felt like that moment was so – it was so perfect of a self-serving government that took a man, to think that he went through what he went through, and then the government basically said, "Okay, your torture is over. Now we're going to reward you for it." It's like, how self-serving.
But at the end of his life,
it was just so disgusting.
At the end of his
life, I know. It's
just like,
I know.
You've got not much more left.
That quote that he said pretty much like, it is your turn to deal with the consequences of your achievement. How fucking hardcore.
Great fucking, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
God damn it.
Anyway, that's just beautiful. So who else, actors-wise?
You was Emily Blunt.
Yeah, who is the other actors? Who is the other actors that you liked?
Well, to me,
Eddie,
I mean,
what do you think?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Brandon.
Go, Brandon. No.
I was going to say, well, we already talked about Robert Downey Jr. This was a revelation. I've seen Downey Jr. in so many more things than just Iron Man. I think that so many people just think of him as Iron Man, but he's a quality freaking actor, right? So I think I was a nice – I think, Sean, you kind of said this. It was a nice reminder of just how quality an actor he is. But, I mean, I'm going to go with the obvious. To me, Cillian Murphy was so understated, so steady, so quiet, so calm, which
absolutely,
you know, which pissed Kitty, you know, the wife off, is because he was so calm. But the way that Cillian Murphy just dominated a scene just from his presence.
Every scene.
Right. Every scene. And he didn't have to say anything. He just stood there, and his mannerisms. And, you know, I don't care about the makeup and all that. What I care about is his emotions just conveyed everything. And I thought that he gave us one of the best performances we've seen in years and years and years.
But dude, we've been fans of this guy for the last 20 years. It's about goddamn time that he finally gets the recognition of what of a fucking amazing actor he is. Probably one of the best actors of his generation.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So I was going to go, I mean, I think it blindsided me personally, but it would be Josh Hartnett. I feel like with the role he had in there, he took advantage of it very well, and it wasn't overpowering. It was very like, it was a cool Josh Hartnett that was like, okay, I feel like I could see you in more movies. Like, where the hell have you been?
Welcome back.
Yeah, welcome back.
Exactly. Like, Pearl Harbor right now?
One of the things he said was theory will only take you so far to Oppenheimer, right? Because Oppenheimer, what is it? Is it Sabri? Sabri? What is it? Oppenheimer?
That's from
Office. Office. Thank you.
I'm sitting there trying to think.
Yeah, you literally got me mixed up on that one, dude. Yeah.
Thank you, Sean. But what is it?
You're welcome.
It's Oppenheimer. It's,
Oppenheimer.
So, like, because it was originally like, did they ask him first? Like, the government came up to him first, and then he was like, hey, like, Oppenheimer, you should be invited here, but overall, you got to take your foot out of the party that you're hanging out with over there.
Just to give you some context, and this is one of the failures of the movie that will not affect my score whatsoever, but it is absolutely one of the failures of the movie, is it didn't adequately talk about why what was going on with communism, why they were so worried about communism, and how many scientists were open to the concept of communism. Mm-hmm. Not maybe open to the concept of communism, but open to at least learning about the concept of communism. But if you look at all these scientists, they all defected from communism or fascism. They were all escaping prejudice or persecution from those governments. Mm-hmm. So to think that they were like, oh, pro-communists were just like – it was the McCarthy show trials. Yep. It was this idea that communists was running wild in America and that they had to shut it down. And That was not quite explained, but I think any movie set in this time period, you just have to realize that McCarthy and the Red Scare and the communists, it was just heavy in politics and heavy in government.
Yep.
Just didn't explain it at all.
Well, and I think my supporting my thought to that, and maybe it's wrong, is that this is a movie that doesn't explain. I don't say mansplain, but it doesn't explain anything, right? It doesn't try to sit there and explain the math behind it or the physics behind it. It just says, you know what, just accept the fact that this is what it is. This is the history. This is the time period. This is the social structure. It's over your head. The math is over your head. Like, they're talking and you just kind of sit there and go, okay, yeah. So I think that, it's not a movie that is trying to set up a history lesson as much as to try to capture a moment in history.
I think it's more of a philosophical movie than it is a scientific technical movie. If you look at something like Big Bang Theory, which I think is very funny show, they rely on technical jokes, right? Technical physics jokes. This movie relied on the philosophical questions. And one of the most beautiful things that you had in this movie was Oppenheimer at one point early on said, nobody gets hurt from theory. Theory doesn't damage anyone. There's no damage that comes from theory, you know, until you actually visually see the black hole, which was what he was working on, the death of a star, you know, nobody's going to get hurt by that. And then all of a sudden he goes from theory to
practice
practicality. Mm-hmm. And the practicality was justified in his mind so beautifully when he said to, I believe it was David Kummerholtz's character, because David Kummerholtz's character would not join the Manhattan Project. He said, I know for sure in the hands of the Nazis, this technology will be devastating. I know for sure in the hands of the Russians.
Yeah,
this will be devastating. I'm not sure how America will, you know, will use it, but I know that the Nazis and the Russians can't get it. So that was his whole predicate, his whole justification for doing what he did. And so I found that Oppenheimer was this logical, rational, reasonable human. And then fast forward to his trial when they said, when did your opinion change? And I think that his answer, basically he didn't give an answer, but his answer was, my opinion never changed.
Yeah.
And that's a heartless thing to say. I was building the bomb because it was necessary to build the bomb. Upon accomplishment of the bomb, Germany was falling. Russia became our ally. There was no need. There was no longer a need to use the bomb. It didn't change my opinion. The facts changed. And mm-hmm. therefore, the logic changed. And that's where I think this whole movie was just brilliant and beautiful, is that he was the steady force throughout the entire movie. He really didn't change. And one of my favorite lines is when Emily Blunt says, you know, how long are they going to let them rake you through the coals or burn you? Do you think you're ever going to get, you know, it's when he goes down the garden path toward her. Do you mm-hmm. remember that at the end of the movie?
Yeah.
And he says, we'll see. And, he, you know, he was right.
I think the intro really foreshadows everything about what you're going to be expecting in this movie, especially the whole quote from Prometheus, you know, and how much, you know, he stole the fire from the gods and then he bestowed it to mankind. And then he had to be like, you know, chained to this rock, you know, to be witness that. And then when you think about it, like Oppenheimer, you know, gave us the atomic fire, you know, and when he was trying to control it, you know, or be, you know, aware or making aware of the danger, you know, the powers that be rose up in anger and punished him, you know. So you literally have that fucking like
the whole theme,
the whole story right there on what it was from, especially from the author who was kind of explaining it, you know, of the American Prometheus, you know. Mm-hmm. I think Nolan did something differently in this movie that it's just something he's been missing for the past few films.
Yep.
That I feel like he's just in another league now of just storytelling.
But it's not just storytelling. I think we need to talk about, I know we're kind of talking about actors and stuff, but we need to talk about the special effects, which are all practical. Everything was practical. Oh, yeah. None of it was digital. And the fact that we have a person in this digital age who's saying, no, let's forsake all the digital, you know, hoo-ha, and let's do practical effects. I mean, you're talking about different league of storytelling. He is, but he's also in a different league of video telling or visual telling. And I think that this movie, I enjoyed Tenet. I did. It was confusing, but I liked Tenet. I hate Interstellar.
I love Tenet.
I hate Interstellar. I don't like Interstellar. Sean, don't watch it. I know I'm in a minority there. I know a lot of people love that.
Yeah.
But this movie, Jeremiah, you are absolutely right, because he transcended to me what filmmaking can do in the 21st century, where we already think that it can do leaps and bounds, because he's saying, no, we don't need to resort to cheap effects. Let's tell a story. Let's let the story structure tell it. Let's let the visuals tell it. And let's let the audience be completely immersed in this movie.
Yeah. It's a 3-hour movie. It's a 3-hour movie. Yeah. It's rated R and it made over $1 billion.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be premature to, maybe premature to say, but I think if you're looking back 25, 35, 100 years from now, you'll see
this is a movie, you know,
the likes of this is the movie where it'll go down with Lawrence of Arabia, it'll go down with Citizen Kane, it'll go down with with the greatest films of all time, the big John Huston pictures, mm-hmm. the, you know, the stuff that was so big that it was why you go to the movies. Because this is why you go to the movies.
Exactly, right? Dude.
It's also too ahead of its time. I feel like it still made so much money, but overall, I don't think people still grasp what they saw. I feel like people, you can't say Lawrence Arabia, those great movies, they're great after 20 years. You look back like, shit, that was a great movie. And you look back now, I mean, this movie for some people caught it, but I feel like some people, it's probably like, oh yeah, that was a long movie. That was cool. But then, it just, the score, really, I mean, I want to talk about the score whenever you get a chance, but so I don't know.
God, the score.
I want to round up a couple actors and give a couple of just what I think is five people who just kind of knocked their little bits out of the park. And it's easy to say Gary Oldman, but Gary Oldman is Harry Truman. That exchange between him and Oppenheimer was just I had to actually look up who the actor was because it was
and
so
then it made
fucking
sense, right?
Yeah, so compelling, so good. So Casey Affleck, he had a very confrontational thing. Didn't care for him as much, but in that same room was okay. And I don't know his name because I can't find him on IMDb. Was the son from the new Frasier television show, and he's in this comedy, and I'm like, oh, he's a terrible actor. And then you watch him; he was the other guy in the room, and he he's a 30-year-old actor. To be where he is at 30, it was fucking phenomenal. So just want to say that one was pretty, pretty damn good. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Who else do I have here? Kenneth Branagh as Niels Bohr was just a delight. Dean DeHaan.
There you go.
Dane DeHaan, he put me in mind like he was so vitriolic toward Oppenheimer, so angry, so hateful of this man. And it turns out that, so he was part of the cabal from the very beginning set up to bring him down. It just made perfect sense.
I like Benny Safdie as Teller. I thought that he was a great juxtaposition, maybe, to
very good,
Oppenheimer.
Yes. And then finally, the guy who played Han Solo, Alden.
Oh yeah,
Alden Ehrenreich.
Mm-hmm. Ehrenreich.
I thought he was great.
He was the Senate. Yeah. The Senate aide.
Yeah,
he has been he's been raked through the coals over in a bunch of different movies, and finally, I felt like he had a shining performance. Was it an Academy Award? No, but it was just one of those performances that kind of jumped off the screen for me when he looks at Robert Downey Jr. and Robert Downey Jr. says, "You know, you told me we would win," and he says, I didn't have all the data. Like you didn't give me all. Give me all the data. I'm like, oh fuck, you're a young staffer that just stood up to. I just loved that dynamic. I thought it was so good.
It's good to see him get the opportunity, that chance to be in something big, because a lot of people was talking shit on him on the Solo movie, and I thought he did well as Han Solo. And he doesn't get the recognition.
When Strauss was pissed off with Oppenheimer got all the scientists to go against me. And then that's when Aiden Ehrenreich, he was like, is it possible they talked about something more important? Like he said that quote in the very end, isn't it possible they talked about something more important? Because at the time,
than you.
And it was like, all these scientists weren't just talking about you, dude. Some of those quotes were just nailed it.
I love Robert Downey Jr.'s reaction when he's looking at him. And then before he goes into the public, he does this creepy smile. He has to put his face on.
He's got to put his face on. Yeah. But no, you know what? Another one, Sean, I think it was so small, but I thought it was so well done, was Tom Conti as Einstein. It was so beautiful. That last speech, that lingering, that last moment, and how he, I think one of the very few times in the movie where he takes the focus completely off of Oppenheimer and puts it somewhere else. And it's weird because, Einstein is this, he's this magical figure for so many, of our brains. And for us to see him as
well,
just
he's the
human,
one who gets the credit, right? Well, he's the one that gets the credit.
He is the one. But at the same time, he is shown in this movie to just be a normal person who is very aware of his situation, right? He's not this quote unquote, God or demigod. He is a human being who is fully aware of his fallibility and the fallibility of the people that he cares about. And Oppenheimer is one of them. I think it's so beautiful.
And I'll tell you right now, I wish that they would make a movie. I wish, someone would make a movie about Einstein that is good, number one. Number two, I feel just from this movie, and this is not doing any of the research, I feel like he came out with relativity and was afraid to go further.
Yeah.
Because there's a one point where Oppenheimer says he refused to believe in all of the all of the basically the bad parts of the combustion or universe that you know that his theory embodied. And it's like maybe he took a step back because somebody said to him, you know, there was the world's going to fall apart. Yeah. And he didn't have the science to back it. Because I thought that was when Oppenheimer reads the notebook and there's less than 1% chance that basically mm-hmm. they're going to start a chain reaction to ruin the whole universe.
Zero would be nice.
Yeah.
Zero would be nice.
Matt Damon.
Can you run this again? You're going to get the same same result. And it's like, I don't know. There was a couple scenes like that where Oppenheimer struck me as this brilliant, brilliant, logical man who was three steps ahead of everyone else. And he was foiled by the stupidest things. Who's the guy that you just said, really good actor with he had the facial, Emily Blunt wouldn't shake his hand.
Oh, Teller.
So mm-hmm. he's standing after they take the bombs away. And he says, well, I gave him both opinions of the scientific community, the good and the bad. And he goes, what about your opinion? Like Oppenheimer never actually gave his opinion. He only looked at science for science's sake and mm-hmm. never really injected himself into it. And I think that is a mark of a true scientist and why he is as brilliant as he is.
I love how I never actually thought about this, but like they made it seem real cool how all these scientists, they know each other. They all mm-hmm. they all study each other. They all go to each other's events a little bit, like Heisenberg, with
lot of respect.
A lot of respect to each other before the war. You know, and it's just it put it in a different aspect that I never actually thought about. Like, okay, maybe they're like, hey, are you aligned with this? Are you giving information to your friend over here who's working for the Axis powers? It is a true community.
Like you said, that they were being hunted down. You know, a lot of ways when you think about it.
But I also don't think, Eddie, to your point, I don't think that there was a lot of political thought in most scientists' head. I think they were interested in physics. They were interested in achieving something, in discovering something.
Eddie, this is a question more to you and Sean to you also. But so the first time I'm watching this movie, because Jeremy, you've seen it twice now?
No, I've only seen it.
Oh, just one. Okay, in that case, this is to everybody. So when I was watching the movie the first time, I was still holding out this belief that Robert Downey Jr. was on the quote-unquote good side up until the end when it's finally kind of fully revealed that he was the one that gave the file and everything. The second time you see it, oh my God, it's like painted clear as day in the first scene that we see of Robert Downey Jr. But were you guys surprised, or at what point did you realize that Robert Downey Jr. was, you know, kind of the foe to Oppenheimer?
The one that's like dragging his name through the mud type
thing. Yeah. When did you realize that he wasn't really a supporter, but or a friend, but really kind of the one who is going after him?
For me, really towards the last 30 minutes of right before. I mean, I think Dr. Hall, which was Sammy Malek, the guy from Queen. What's his name?
Remy Malek.
I would say moments before that, like the whole last scene of when it was the black and white where Strauss is in
kind front of when it was revealed.
Yeah, it was like, oh, no, but crap.
I guess when I say that now. Is if you watch it a second time, for me at least, it's like it's so clear and it's so plain. It's almost like watching Psycho again, you know, after you know the reveal and being like, or The Sixth Sense maybe mm-hmm. is probably a better one, where you're like, oh, shit, it is clear as day. Like Nolan is throwing this in our face. And for me, I was the same way as you guys. It wasn't until the actual reveal of the movie that I said, holy shit.
You want to believe he's a good guy because he's with the government. He's with the United States government.
And it's Robert Downey Jr.
You want to believe he's a good guy. And it's sad that what they did with all the scientists, if that's really what they did. Who was the fair that Oppenheimer, like all of a sudden he was naked on the couch smoking a cigarette. Like, and she's naked. And
that was Jean, the girl who
Slim walked past. What the hell are you watching? It's like, this is the worst thing to be jumping at right now. Was she killed? That's my question, I guess.
She killed herself. She was
actually, no. If you watch it over again, you actually see another person.
Yeah, there's hands. Mm-hmm. There was hands. People with black gloves.
There's reports that she might have been killed because she was part of the
interesting.
You know, part of the party and
Communist
shit like that.
Party.
There's a split scene where you saw someone pushing her in.
to your question, Brandon, I didn't know until the very last minute when he actually just revealed his whole evil design plan. Yeah. And I was just like, oh, shit. Yeah. Here am I just like rooting for this fucking guy and he's all doing this whole fucking thing. And now I'm rooting for like, you know, the evil empire and shit like that.
I mean, even at the beginning, even at the beginning of his testimony where he's going out there and you know, how do I rip him down? How do I do, you know? And I'm like, oh, so he's a good guy. He's fine. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, no, he's not. He's evil Robert Downey Jr. It's God, U.S. Marshals all over again.
Was he trying to be a scientist?
No.
Oppenheimer, like he made fun of all this, something that he created or something that he
the isotopes. So, yeah. So he wanted to export, or he wanted to ban isotopes being sent to other countries. And what Downey Jr. was, or what Oppenheimer was saying is that basically the isotopes themselves won't cause other people to have bad things. So that it's not really worth banning those. And what's his name? Strauss had such a huge like
ego
focus on that was kind of his platform that he stood on. And Oppenheimer just made a joke about it. And that joke is what carried him through. And then the whole Einstein passing, you know, without looking at him, it just all built up in Strauss's head.
When it was all revealed like about his plan and what he wanted to do, like when I was done with the film, like I was thinking back of like some of the things that he were talking about, like which you mentioned where he felt like he was humiliated by it amongst his peers and everything like that. And I'm like, oh my God, they were leading little bread trails and shit like that, you know. I bet you if I see this movie again, I'm gonna see a whole kind of a different kind of movie, like, you know, leading up to like what we like, you know, the final ending, which I have to say is one of the greatest fucking endings that we've seen in a very long time.
Storylines building up to it. Now, please watch it again. It's insane.
I'm not going to lie, dude. This movie felt like a ticking time bomb throughout the whole time. Like it was ready to go off any fucking moment, dude. I love horror films. This felt like one of the most scariest movies I've seen in a very long time, man. Because it, whatever you watch, it stays with you. And that's fucking haunting shit right there.
Yeah.
I will say the JFK foiling his commitment or confirmation was one of my favorite parts of the movie.
Definitely.
They're like some young senator from Massachusetts, Kennedy, John F. Kennedy. I'm
doesn't,
like,
doesn't like that. You went, doesn't like that you dragged his name through the mud. It's like, yeah.
What do you guys think about the ending?
So I was going to say every time Cillian Murphy did something like this, the music just like, oh shit, turn it down. You know, this is like amazing. Like when he starts to think, like, I need to start thinking like this man. When he puts his hand to his, like, he's thinking like, oh my God, the score just gave me chills every time. And
it captured what was going on in his head. It's like, imagine like, you know, the most brilliant mind just can't control these thoughts in his head, you know? It's crazy, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. The last shot in the end, where you have Oppenheimer and you finally get the Einstein and you get an idea of what they were talking about.
Beautiful.
It's one of the most gorgeous scenes because see them talking, and you see Robert Downey Jr. in the background, right? But it never focuses on him because it doesn't fucking matter about him and shit. It matters what they're talking about.
Was that in color?
Yes.
Yeah. It was in color.
So that was from Oppenheimer's perspective, not Robert Downey Jr.
No. And that's the whole point. Like, you know, you see Strauss in the background, and I'm not going to lie, man. Those last four words that he says, like, I believe we did, gave me chills to the bones. And then you just see a person and his eyes are open and knowing that he opened up this hell gate. And there's nothing that he can do about that, you know?
Yeah.
And here, okay, so I loved the ending. I loved that, you know, that fear that nuclear missiles will be used for, or that the atom bombs, whatever you want to call them, what his creation will be used to basically cover the earth in darkness and dismay and destroy humanity as we know it. However, knowing what we know now, that we are the only people who have ever dropped bombs, saw the aftermath of the greatest destructive power on the planet in those bombs. And they went, wow, this is real. This is really 200 million people dying from bombs. This is really 200 million people dying from the after effects of bombs. And I see, even the hardest hearted saw the devastation that came with it. And that's why we haven't had another bomb dropped anywhere in the world.
Atomic, a bomb or H bomb.
The second bombs. The second thing I think is true is we have since created an arsenal of so many bombs that the destruction is true in everyone's mind. They know it's going to happen. And if anyone else is stupid enough to use their bombs, they will cease to exist. And mm-hmm. I think that this deterrent system that's been created by, you know, I think perhaps an unethical dropping of two bombs has created something unexpected. And it gives me hope for humanity that as bad of a country as you think our country may be, or all the countries across the world, no one has dropped a bomb. As evil or as virtuous, whatever you want to say, no one has done it. And that should give you some hope that mankind understands at least a little bit the destructive power of what these can do. And I think that's important.
Fuck. Let's hope. That brings us to the end of review. Now it's time of the podcast where each of the hosts provides a score on the following scale. Mr. Kennedy, can you please provide the scale?
Yes.
Ask not what your country could do for you, but what you could do for your country.
Yeah, I mean, that was it right there, dude.
All
right,
ready, guys? 0, the perfect movie. You don't need shit to enjoy it. 1, a feel-good first cocktail. 2, a happy buzz. 3, an Uber lifting home. 4, rough morning walk of shame. 5, blackout shit-faced spring break drunk. Gentlemen.
Are we going to do our new thing that we're talking about, folks?
Sure.
Yes.
So okay. Who wants to explain like how we're going to actually do our scores for season 5?
So basically, because I manipulate the scores in the past, because I don't like the way that some people score their movies, we are creating a system. Jeremiah has proposed a system where we, before everyone gives a review, we reveal what our scores are to each other and on the video. And then subsequently, we will give our scores and we will not be able to change them from when we have revealed them to each other. Is that accurate?
Well, the reason for this, listeners, is that somebody, Sean, our host, loves to give point twos when there's a 4 given by somebody like me, which we're
like
keeping
I said,
ourselves
I
honest.
Can no longer manipulate scores.
Nope.
So. All right, so write down your scores, guys.
Mine's written.
All right, so here we go.
Listeners, just know this. This is going to be very mysterious, and authentic. It makes it more exciting for you get to be a part of this when you see this on our YouTube page.
1.
Yes.
2.
Wait. I'm writing.
Eddie,
it's taking you a long time to draw that 0, buddy.
That circle, man. That circle. It's one continuous line. Right.
It's one line. All right.
1.
Are we ready?
Okay. Ready?
1, 2, 3. Oh, Eddie, you're such a dick.
Fuck you, Eddie.
Oh,
you
Eddie.
Are you serious?
Eddie, go ahead and give us a score for what you for Oppenheimer.
This is a beautiful movie, beautiful score. It's definitely going to be one of those movies that's in the top 100 AFI's list and the high top 10 movies of it. I think it's Emily Blunt, Robert Downey Jr., Cillian Murphy. I mean, we didn't even get to some of these smaller names. Matt Damon, we didn't even talk about Matt Damon. I don't know why, but Matt Damon was awesome. However, I do have to say there is tiny moments where it didn't explain enough with, I think Sean, you even said, it didn't explain enough of the communist side of things. Like, I felt like I was lost at times, many times actually in this movie. I felt like I was lost at times. And I don't think I was lost too many times in this movie. And because of that, I honestly, that's why I gave this score. I think it's a beautiful movie. I'm going to watch it again. It's probably easily the movie of 2023, but I'm giving this a 0.33, just underneath a shot, so right above a half a shot. So this is between the perfect movie and a feel-good first cocktail, more leaning towards the perfect movie. But that's a 0.33.
Fuck you.
Jeremiah. Jeez. Oh, sorry, guys. At least it's not like a 4 or a 3 or a 2. Like, it's a good movie. I was around you guys' score.
Okay. It's not surprising, folks. I'll explain the reason why I gave it a 0 is because there was a quote from Paul Thomas Anderson.
One of the greatest.
One of the amazing directors out there. He says, when a filmmaker is as strong as Christopher Nolan is pointing a finger at you and telling you where to go, you listen and the audience will be rewarded for it. And that's the fucking truth here, man. I believe that we're witnessing greatness right now. Yep. He's probably the most influential directors of our time. This movie has changed the way how we view cinema in theaters. And it's something that I wish I could experience, but I remain hopeful for many years to come that we get to be a part of it. This movie should win best editing, best score, best cinematographer, best supporting actor, best actor, best actress, best director, and best picture. This is the reason why I score this film a zero, because it is a fucking perfect movie. This movie should wipe everything out in this year's Academy Award. It's that fucking great. I can't see anything else. So that's why I give it a zero.
So I saw this movie in the theater alone. And as soon as I walked out after sitting and watching all the credits and then letting all the lights come on and, you know, the people with their little brooms come and start, you know, cleaning up the popcorn. And I walked out and I looked at the world just a little bit differently. Like, this is a movie that changes your perception of the world around you. And I think that only true art can do that. And this is true art. I texted up my family and I said, I just walked out of the best picture, best actor, best actress, best editing, best.
Yeah.
Same thing that you just said, Jer. I said that and I will hold to that. That I think that this isn't a movie that you just watch and you forget about. In fact, I still remember sitting in a theater and watching it. And that's because the impact it made on me then and the impact it made on me last night when I rewatched it on Blu-ray. There are some pieces of art that will last forever. And I think this is one of those pieces of art that will just last forever. And it's because of the complete amalgamation of cinema. Right. It's the editing, it's the directing, it's the writing, it's the acting, it's all of that together.
Yeah.
That this is a movie, like we said, is going to be, you know, studied, and it's going to be, praised for years and years and years and decades to come after we're dead. That being said, anybody who doesn't see this as a perfect movie, I respect you, Ed, but all I'm going to tell you is this: watch it one more time. And I think it becomes stronger with another watch. I urge everybody, see this one twice. I know it's 6 hours of your life. Give 6 hours of your life to this movie.
It's worth it.
It's absolutely worth it. Eddie, I respect you and I respect your score, but I think watch it again and you're going to catch so much more and you're going to like it more, because I know that I did, and that was after loving it the first time.
I wish I would have watched this movie in the movie theater. I regret it.
Oh, same here. Yeah, definitely.
No, but it's a zero. It is a perfect film. I think it's one of the top five greatest movies made. I really truly think that it's gonna stand the test of time. So, Sean, you're up.
Nice.
Once in a lifetime, you get a movie that merges technical brilliance with acting brilliance with just visual spectacular visuals. I look back and perhaps I'm arrogant to suggest it's anything like Citizen Kane or Lawrence of Arabia or Casablanca or The Sound of Music. But yeah. I believe that this movie captures the three elements that make movies absolutely spectacular. I think the visuals were as good as any visuals you'll ever see in any movie. Visually, the movie was stunning. From the costumes to the sets to the pacing to the sheer way the movie was shot cinematographically. Mm-hmm. This movie was perfection. It was like a director who's directed 1,000 times picked up a camera and said, here's the most natural way to shoot this bioepic and make it interesting. And it didn't feel forced. It didn't feel new. It didn't feel old. It felt natural. That is a very difficult thing to accomplish, where I wasn't even thinking about the cinematography until it was over. And then I'm like, man, those shots were just so beautifully framed. The last shot with the water hitting his hat and his piercing blue eyes staring out into the darkness, that scene alone was just gorgeous. So I think visually, movie was spectacular. I also think a movie like Lord of the Rings visually was spectacular. But I don't think Lord of the Rings winning 11 Academy Awards, including Best Picture or Best Director, didn't have the acting behind it like this movie does. So this movie not only has spectacular visuals, but the acting was as good as acting is ever going to get on screen. You are never going to get an ensemble cast better than this movie, from top to bottom, from the person who had one line to Cillian Murphy and Emily Blunt nailed every word, every syllable, every line that was written was beautifully and perfectly delivered. And the third thing is, as I look at a movie, why do I watch movies? To be entertained, to learn a little bit, and to be wowed. This is a wow movie. It's a movie about fucking physics. And I'm on the edge of my seat. And Christopher Nolan did that. And that's why you go to the movies. Because you go to the movies for an experience that you can't get anywhere else. And this movie gave us an experience that we will never perhaps get again, but maybe we will. This is the type of movie that will live on in infamy. It is the, like Eddie said, AFI top 10. I think that it will, it'll go against some of the greatest directors, some of the greatest films ever made. This is Christopher Nolan's jewel. And I think that he'll never top this. I really believe that. I don't think he'll ever top this. That's it. It's a zero for me. I think this movie was just a, I think it was one of the greatest movies of our generation. I'm not sure we're going to get another one.
That's a good point.
All right. So you take those scores and divide by four, Eddie. What do you get? What does Oppenheimer get?
Yes. Oppenheimer told General Groves, it's near zero. So it's 0.0825. It's really near
Jeremiah,
zero.
Where does that put us on the list? that's gotta be close to the top, if not the second movie.
It's the third movie of our list, actually. It's number three. We have a brand new top three.
So what is better than Oppenheimer?
Field of Dreams.
Empire Strikes Back is a 0.0625. And our number one movie is the only movie that we have given a zero throughout our whole catalog, Saving Private Ryan.
Where's the Sound of Music?
Sound of Music is a 0.56.
So it's Saving Private Ryan, Empire Strikes Back, and Oppenheimer, right?
Yes. And Eddie, you had a dynamic hand in all three of those, finally giving a zero. Not giving a zero when we thought you should have. Not giving a zero when we hope that you should have. But we love you.
I've been so hesitant to put Christopher Nolan in this pantheon of great directors. And it's just I've been foolish. Yeah. He is a great director. He is a Spielberg. He is Brian De Palma. He's Martin Scorsese. I actually would argue that he's kind of he's more in line with the older directors, the John Hustons and I can't think.
He's so natural.
Yeah.
You know what? I mean, he and I think that you got to recognize his ability to create visuals without the use of a computer.
Now that we're at the end of the podcast, it's time for one of our gentlemen to tell us which movie we'll be watching and reviewing next week. This is something new we're doing. Since Brandon has the first pick of season five, Brandon, which movie are we doing and why?
So as we talked about earlier, we're with this season kind of doing the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon kind of thing where you have a movie and then the next gentleman in line needs to pick another movie that has the same actor or actress, director, composer, writer, you know, cinematographer, something like that. So it's going to kind of create this chain that we're going to start here with this movie and then end sometime in December. And so we're really excited for this with Oppenheimer because we picked this as a group. And one of the reasons we picked this as a group is because it had so many different actors and actresses and so many different ways
so
that we
many.
Could go. I mean, I sat there for hours and hours trying to figure out which direction I wanted to go. And with the help of my wife, I am going to go with the Emily Blunt direction. And so we are going to be talking about next week, 2006's Devil Wears Prada. So we are going from World War II to the fashion world. And I'm excited. I've only seen this movie once.
Meryl Streep.
And I saw it when Emily Blunt was still a brand new up and comer. So we're going to be tackling Devil Wears Prada next week for you guys.
That's a zero if I ever saw one. So
Brandon, I love you. I love you so much.
I'm so excited to do this movie.
I didn't expect you to go in this direction, man. I thought you were going to do something else, dude.
So this is exciting. And just so you guys know, as listeners, this is the first time that they have heard my choice.
And so we are very excited. I hope that they're as excited as I am. And I know that I hope they're as excited as my wife is, because finally we get a little bit more Emily Blunt and Anne Hathaway. And who's the other one, Sean? I can't remember who's the other one in Devil Wears Prada.
Anne Hathaway, no, Emily Blunt, Simon Baker, Stanley Tucci.
No, the main one.
Stanley
Tucci. Who's the devil? Oh, that's who it is. We're going to go ahead and tackle our first Meryl Streep in 5 seasons.
Oh,
that's awesome. But jeez, yeah. Man.
Let's do it.
I mean, Sicario.
Jerry, you're going to love it,
tomorrow.
Man. If anything, it's going to be a fun discussion.
Sicario is deep.
Oh, by the way, Into the Woods has both Emily Blunt and Meryl Streep.
It does.
Yeah.
Oh, shoot.
All right. If you enjoyed our review or a fan of the podcast, we ask you please subscribe wherever you're listening and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. I will say that last year we saw an incredible bump in our viewership. We are asking for 50 new listeners, 50 new listeners, one per week, to shoot us up into the upper echelons of the podcasting pantheon, I guess you could call it. We are attempting to get some ads and some people interested, and the only way we can do that is to increase our viewership. We ask that you please tell your friends, your family, your grandma, anyone who can listen to podcasts, tell them about our podcast. We're going to do some great movies. If you guys want to write in and suggest some movies, we'll absolutely include those. So please tell your friends and listen weekly. We're going to produce 52 episodes at minimum this year, one per week for the entire year. We did 54 episodes last year. We're very proud of that. Season 5 will be 52 episodes at minimum. And really excited for this season to take off. So you can find us on Instagram at the Dot Gentleman Podcast. The dot means a lot. You can visit our website, thegentlemanpodcast.com. And of course, if you want to reach out to us, it's hosts with an S, HOSTS, at thegentlemanpodcast.com. Thank you all for listening so much, and happy new year. And we are looking forward to a very warm, prosperous, and wonderful 2024.
Happy season 5, guys.
Peace out, everyone.
Cheers, gentlemen.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank.
I think that was our best first episode of a season after a delay of an hour and 25 minutes.
I would agree. I would agree with you.
That was good. Good job, guys. Okay, so...